Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2017. Lecture 24, delivered on November 28, 2017. The title of this lecture is Cost of Capital.
Today, cost of capital. And this is the last major thing that we do in here. And you have only the homework and the quiz. I don't have you do the test, online test for this chapter, just because there's so much to do catching up, and we will have an, I'll give you the information for one last in-class quiz for you to do over the coming weekend. So stay tuned for that at the end of the lecture, the information you'll need for that. As I said, this is cost of capital. I've sort of gone through the pieces of this before, but just as a starter, the fundamental equation of accounting is, of course, your total liabilities plus your owner's equity, stockholder's equity. Let me put it stockholder's equity. Is going to equal your total assets. And that is how it's done. Everything pivots in accounting around this fundamental equation right here. Now in finance, we recognize this equation, but we do have a modification of it. And you might have figured that out by now. We don't really care about total liabilities and stockholders' equity. What we care about, not the book value of them, which is what we've been looking on the accounting sheets for, we care about the market value. So put up here, market value of, and the market value of. So, in other words, if we had a financial statement that gave, let's say, long-term debt, equals $100 million. I mean, that's the number that's on the books, but we would want in finance to look at what the market says it's worth. Let's say that the overall, their debt is selling at 98.24. We would look on, just at the mark, at the price that is currently running for that debt. And we can see that it's selling at a somewhat of a discount to par, about 1.76 to par. So for our purposes, the total liability number would include not 100 million, it would include 98.24 million. That's what we would use in finance. We would not use that 100 million because that really doesn't mean anything to, other than for accounting purposes, in the real world of the value of this firm, the value of its total assets. That book value is not what the market's going to say. You can, well, I paid this for this car, so I expect to get that back. Well, you're not going to get that back, no. There was a wonderful listing on Craigslist about a month and a half ago. This guy was selling this computer system, and he wanted $1,000 for it. And he said, don't mess with me. I know what I paid for this. Well, he bought that computer system in 2007. Boy, there's some, maybe it has some vintage value on the Antique Roadshow. Why, this is a highly collectible old piece of trash. We have to use the actual market's assessment because that's where everything is going to be driven. And the same is true for the stockholders' equity. There's going to be a number on the books there at the bottom at the balance sheet, total stockholders' equity. And that number is the number that would be used for the fundamental equation of accounting in accounting. But for us, no, that's not going to be it at all. We're going to say, what's the market cap of this company? What's the market cap? So, for example, really quick, just to pull one up here for your viewing pleasure. Let me grab one real quick here. SEC.gov. Now, filings, company filing search. And I don't know. What would be a good company? Fortune 500. I'm curious about something myself. Is anyone familiar with a company called Yum Brands? It's Fortune 500. Do you know it? Yeah, it's a franchise operation. Although, if I'm not mistaken, they also have corporate. Yum Brands owns Taco Bell, KFC, and several others. It got some bad media attention that's blown up like an idiot thing on Facebook and a couple of other social media where they're claiming that Yum Brands is supporting a very unpopular candidate for Senate. And everyone should boycott Taco Bell and boycott this company for supporting it. No, Yum Brands is just a franchisor. One of their franchisees who owns some of Taco Bell's in Florida is a supporter of this very unpopular candidate. But the company itself, and the unfortunate part is that they're ignoring it. Yum Brands itself is still doing their happy face social media. Hey, here's our quarterly statements. Hey, here's our great food at our different restaurants. Quit it. You got to face these things. But anyway, I'm just curious about Yum Brands. I won't say a name. I don't want to get in any hot water for hurting someone. Okay, there's Yum Brands. Okay, now the market cap is $27.745 billion. This is a big company. I mean, who knew? KFC, Taco Bell, and all that. So moving back over here, what was that? Yum. Oh, okay. Well, there's a creative ticker symbol. And let's go for a 10K on it real quick here. And one of the things, you've seen me doing this over and over again in this class. I want to get you used to doing that kind of, what I'm doing here. You're going to have projects in your class where you're going to have to find information about companies. And I'd love to have you have this as a natural reaction. Okay, let's see what the market says about it, Yahoo Finance, and then let's go to the SEC documents and have a look at what the financials are. And that way we've got some good information that is very strong to support whatever you're trying to do as far as a project goes in a class. And financial statements, consolidated statements of income. I do wish they'd all just call those stupid things. There we go. Now let's look down here at the total stockholders, the shareholders' equity. Wait, what? My color is meatloaf dense. What's the... Oh, duh. Oh, I just get good heavens. Oh, well, here's an interesting thing. Their financial statement says that they are dog meat. They are toast. They are so low that you can play handball on the curb with their financials. But here... it says that the company's worth negative $5.65 billion. Well, gee. Well, let's go out there and tell the stock market they are just plain wrong. Do you see what I mean? I wasn't expecting that. I hadn't checked into Yum Brands. I like to go into these blind so you can see my reaction to things. This is a little more of a reaction than I was expecting. The financial statements say that that thing right there would be a massive negative number. But the market says something different. They're saying KMA. This is nearly a $28 billion equity value on this company. So you see, this is a stark example of why we in finance do not use accounting numbers when we don't have to, or we adjust them as we must. In my 241 class, and 341, which is this class one level up, I'm showing them just how you do all the tweaks and the turns to get what we need to see real money value. And in this case, yowza, that's going to make a very big impact on what you see as a total asset value of this company. Using the book value of stockholders' equity would get you a very different number for the total assets than using the market value. And so, as I just said, you can believe the accounting numbers and go up and talk to the stock market. Hey, stock market, you're all wrong. Fix it right now. Chop, chop. Or you can go with what the market's saying about this company. Your call. That's why we in finance kind of enjoy our job, because in the sense that we see that there is a necessity of the accounting information. It's absolutely crucial. It is the center of everything as far as government filings go, as far as talk on the news shows goes. But we know very well that there's a very different story when you look at the numbers that the market itself is determining. I recall once, a long time ago, I was out at sea, and there was this one guy on board, very smart guy, very bright. He was telling us that the sharks in the water were not particularly dangerous to people. And so we were inviting him to jump into the water to see. And that was when he decided that he might believe us, that bull sharks, when they get together, can be quite dangerous. Anyway, where was I? Okay, now, let's get down to the basics. I've tried my best here to convince you that the market value is what really is important, at least as far as decision-making goes for you personally in your investments and for you in your work in life that's just coming up soon in the corporate world. So now, let's try something here real quick. Madam, I'm going to lend you money for this project you've got. You're going to earn a return. The return on this project is going to be, let's say, 12%. Now, I'm going to lend you some money, and then this guy's going to buy some stock for you, combine them together to finance it. Now, the weighted average cost of the capital to do this project is going to be 15%. What do you say? Yes, you're going to use money that costs 15% to get a project that does 12%. Is that right? No. Okay, good. You had me worried there. I was going to say, you're one of those three humanities majors I have in this class. But it's a good project. No, clearly we need to know the cost of capital. The cost of capital is going to tell us whether or not projects are go or no go. You've seen me use that word, that term, cost of capital, for some of my net present value evaluations. So here's how we do this. We recognize that there are different sources of capital in a company. The one, of course, is debt. The cost of debt. And I put this under cost of capital. Component. Costs of capital. Now, the components are debt and equity. Now, debt is pretty straightforward, although you do have to watch yourself, because when we say that, what's your cost of debt? Well, that's the coupon rate on it. That would be the first approach, and I think I've already done that one in this. Really, though, what we would want to use is the yield to maturity on the debt. Instead of the coupon rate, we would actually, for the cost of debt, we would probably want to use YTM instead of the coupon. Remember how as the debt fluctuates above and below the par value, the yield to maturity deviates from the coupon rate. So the coupon rate is just what we say we're paying, but the actual cost of the capital is what the market says the cost should be. So in this case, though, the cost of debt, however you want to do it, we're going to put here R sub D. Now, sometimes you're going to just grab the coupon. If you want to do it a little better, you're going to go and get the yield to maturity on the debt, the YTM, for this calculation, okay? Look, think of it this way. You own a very nice car. It's a 1977 Pinto. Now, for those of you who don't know what a Pinto was a car. It was a little boxy car, and it had this really bad habit. If you bumped it 5 miles per hour from behind, it turned into a fireball. It was so cool. I mean, we would follow Pintos to see if anyone would hit them so we could, oh, yeah, man. Your Pinto. Okay, now, it's a car that's worth $200. You paid $200 for it. Yeah, you paid too much, I know, but hey, it's for your kids and, you know, the one you don't like so he can go off to college. Okay, now, you buy the insurance on it, $200 worth of insurance. Okay, suddenly you find out that these have gone classic. I mean, they're even being bought by movie studios so that they don't have to wire explosives into the cars for the awesome scenes. They can just, someone tap that with a hammer, pop, whoa. Okay. It's now, you can sell this on eBay for $10,000. So which is the value of the car? Are you going to treat this as a $200 car or a $10,000 car? Yeah, you see, that's where the market comes into play, not historical value. Coupons are a historical value. Yields are the market value. So if I say the coupon rate is 5%, but the yield to maturity is 5.25%, then I would probably want to believe the market, the 5.25%, for the R sub D, the cost of debt. Follow me on that. Again, it's just purely the choice. Now, you've seen me. I grab the coupon sometimes because I'm lazy. I don't want to look up the yield to maturity on the debt. But at the same time, do recognize that the cost of capital is R sub D. But companies get to deduct their interest expense on debt. Companies get to deduct it. It's, remember, the revenue minus costs is your earnings before interest and taxes minus your interest expense gives you your earnings before taxes, and then minus your taxes gives you your net income. So in other words, interest expense is tax deductible for corporations. By the way, there's an interesting thing about there's a tax overhaul, reform package going through Congress right now. They eliminate the interest expense deduction for mortgages, for people. They didn't even contemplate taking away the same interest deduction for corporations. So just as a little side note, how the tilt of this tax plan is that, well, we're going to stop letting people deduct the interest that they pay on their mortgages. But by golly, we're not going to touch, we wouldn't even dream of touching the same deduction, even more broadly applied to the tune of hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars of lost tax revenue to the corporations. It's an interesting little twist. And I'll leave it at that. Okay, anyway. So, in other words, for our purposes, the cost of debt, whether you use a coupon or yield to maturity, whichever one you use, the actual cost of debt is what that we would calculate is after taxes. So it would be 1 minus the the tax rate, the marginal tax rate on the corporation, times the R sub D. That would be the one that you would use in the calculation of weighted average cost of capital. Marginal tax rate. Marginal tax rate. Now, you can go, and that was what I was going to, actually, I had those tax rates for my other class, and for my 341 class. Let me see if I can grab them real quick here, just for your purposes. Okay. Let me see if I can pull one. There it is. Okay, so this is the corporate tax structure. Now, here's how you do this little trick. First of all, notice something interesting about as the corporation's taxable income, and this is EBT. This is EBT right here. As this goes up, you have a progressive tax system. But what that means, interestingly enough, is as your company's profit grows, you have a larger tax shield on using debt. That one minus, that's a Greek letter tau, which T-A-U, which represents the marginal tax rate. So in other words, a corporation that would be $100,000 to $335,000 in profit, well, spank, boy, that irritates me. Look at that. You see this weirdness right here? It's not really a progressive tax system. See how it rises and falls and then rises? And then for the largest companies on Earth, in the United States, I should say, it actually is lower than it is for small companies. These are called small companies, 15 to 18 million in taxable income, that's a small company. For the largest companies in the country, the tax marginal tax rate on the last dollar of profit they earn is actually lower. Now, there are all kinds of excuses for this, well, this, that, and the other thing, but it's clear that the tax policy is driven by the power of the corporations to have political influence over tax rates, over the Congress, over the president. Anyway, what you do is you look for the EBT of the company that you're looking at. Now, I'm going to go here and look at, just real quick, just for the purposes of this, statements of income. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to go down here to look at earnings before taxes, operating profit, income, okay. Before income taxes, $1.3 billion. Sometimes it's really hard to find what number is what. Every company likes to use its own names for things, as I had mentioned before. But it looks like this company, am I right? Do you income? Yeah, okay. So in other words, at that level, at one point, wait, from continuing operations, looks like just a little bit south of $1 billion. Go over here to the tax table. That would mean that they are in the 35% marginal tax bracket. That's how you tell what one minus tau should be. In this case, it should be 0.65. It's kind of a pain in the butt, but I actually, sadly, keep a copy of these tax tables in an Excel sheet just to make sure that I can do it right. Anyhow, so in other words, in this company, Yum Brands, if their yield to maturity average is, let's say, 4.2%, yield to maturity average is 4.2%. In other words, taking all their debt together and doing a weighted average of the yields to maturity is 4.2%. Then that would be the R sub D that we would consider. And then the R after taxes sub D would be 1 minus 0.35 times 4.2%. So in other words, their after tax cost of debt is a rather surprisingly low number. Grab a calculator here, and I will do 0.65 times 4.2, 2.73%. There you go. That's your cost of debt. That's a component cost of capital. And that's how you do it. And the problems don't get it much harder than that in the quiz and the homework that you'll do for this. Now, let's go over here to equity. Equity, there are different kinds of equity, and they come in two categories of different kinds. On the one hand, there is common equity. And on the other hand, there is preferred equity. Now, as I said, preferred equity just isn't, companies just aren't using preferred equity that much anymore. I mean, I reach to find companies that have preferred stock outstanding these days. And you saw that there are certain industries where it is more evident. Real estate types of companies, development types of companies will tend to use preferred equity. But in general, preferred equity is not that commonly used anymore. Common equity is. Now, there are two kinds of common equity. There is internally generated and there is externally generated. Internally generated is how much the company makes that belongs to the shareholders. Internally generated is, in accounting terms, the cost of net income. The cost of net income. In other words, internally generated equity is, in accounting terms, the cost of net income. The cost of your profit. Now, that seems a little odd. Saying that your profit is a cost is definitely a finance concept. Your profit is actually a cost. It's a cost of having shareholders. You, sir, you have gotten a really good job out of coming out of your degree program here at this fine university. I mean, you're making great. I mean, they offered you a really good salary, $30,000 a year. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. Let the good times roll. Yeah, that student loan program, you're going to be paying. Yeah, you'll be eating canned Spam. No, you won't. That's too expensive for you. We're talking Alpo, the generic brand. Okay, now, that's your profit, but that's actually a cost. That's the cost that you are paying for not doing something else. It's actually a cost to you. When a company earns money at the bottom line, that bottom line belongs to the shareholders. That means that to the corporation, it is the cost of having shareholders. You follow that? You, sir, you got married, and she got married. Now, you are both happily in your marriages, But the cost of your marriage, the cost of the spouse, is what you could have gotten otherwise. You? Meh. Okay. But what I'm trying to get at here is in finance, we see profit as cost because that profit belongs to the shareholders. It's the cost of carrying them. It is I can't even describe it further, but when you make money in a corporation, if you've got owners of that corporation, that's their money. That's the cost of keeping them. You got them by selling them stock. Now you keep them because they have the claim to that money that's at the bottom line. That's a cost. Now the cost of the externally generated is the same as the cost of those of your new shareholders. These are the new shareholders, what it costs to get them. But it carries an extra whammy because the cost of getting them includes a cost of paying the investment bankers to bring them to you. These guys, you've already got them. You've already got them. But these people right here, you have to pay something extra to get them. So that means that the cost of externally generated equity is going to be more than the cost of internally generated equity. Sometimes that's a pretty big amount. Sometimes it's not that much at all. You had a question?
Yeah, I do. Just trying to wrap my head around profit cost. But even if you hold any profit on the bottom line as retained earnings, it's still a cost?
Well, yeah, because it still belongs to the shareholders. Yeah, because they have the legal claim to it. You cannot do anything with that money in retained earnings that is contrary to the wealth maximization of the shareholders. Okay? That is theirs. Okay, think about it this way. These people have all been infected by a virus that turned them into zombies. Okay? They're at your door. Brains. Okay, now what you do is you just take a small Black and Decker drill and you drill in and you pull out a small part of your brain. Okay? No, no, no. We're talking about just take out the part where you learned accounting. And you toss that out to them. Well, yeah, that's the dividend. Okay? They're going, and then they're going to come back to your door. Brains. Because they know you got more. Oh, I'm investing that brain. I'm going to ISU and taking Professor C's class. So it'll be a bigger brain when I get it back to you. They're still going to say, brains. I have no idea how far I could take this analogy.
I understand.
You understand the analogy or you understand why they don't let me teach children anymore.
Yeah.
Okay. And then preferred equity is on its own. Now, technically, there is a internally generated preferred equity, externally generated preferred equity. But the truth of the matter is that in reality, the cost brokers, the cost investment bankers charge for doing an offering of preferred equity is very low. It's the same thing with this. You notice that I don't have old debt, new debt. It's just because new debt doesn't cost hardly any more because the investment bankers can unload that stuff really fast and they don't charge much at all. So we really don't distinguish between internal and external on debt or on preferred equity. But when you're talking about common equity, that is a very big difference. And I gave you that one example in my own rainmaking days where, I mean, that guy wanted some money, a couple of mil, and we were going to whack him with like 25% we were going to take for ourselves. So the cost there was staggering on it. Now, I do want to point out that there are some cases, and I got to go back to this. I almost forgot this. In normal circumstances, you don't worry about old debt versus new debt, that float. There are some places where you do. There are these turnaround artists who will come in and save your company. You need $1 billion. We're the people who can bring that to the table. We're going to make you do this, this, and this. You're going to fire a whole lot of employees, ruin their lives. We're going to move your operations overseas to China, which means that your suppliers here in the United States will all collapse. But we're going to save your company we're going to bring to the table $1 billion in debt. We're going to load you with, our consulting fee is $300 million. So what you're really going to borrow is $1.3 billion. And then we'll just write ourselves a check out of that for our three. So you see there the float in those kinds of turnaround specialist deals. That is where a float can knock you dead. And there was there was a candidate. I guess I mentioned this earlier. 2008, was it? Was it 2012? Maybe it was 2012. I can't remember. It's been so long ago now. But one of the candidates was one of these turnaround specialists, and he had done Staples. And he had burdened them with a staggering amount of debt, about 25% of which didn't go to the company. It just went for his and his group's consulting fees. That was Mitt Romney. And it was just an amazing amount of money that the company was burdened with that they had to pay back. So sometimes there really would be a difference here. But for most purposes, we assume there's no float. And with preferred equity, there's no float. Now, moving along, I've got your cost, component cost of capital, your cost of debt. Okay, that's after tax. Use that for this. Now, I'm going to put some notation down here. Here's the notation for the after-tax cost of debt. The cost of internally generated equity, I'm going to designate with an R sub E, cost of equity. The externally generated, I'm going to designate R sub N. The N represents new, because this is new money that you're bringing into the company. And the cost of preferred equity is R sub P. Now, I'm going to give you a very simple version of this equation. Okay. The weight of debt in the capital structure is going to be the market value of debt over the market value of the total assets . The weight overall, just overall, the weight of equity is going to be the market value of the equity. In other words, the market cap over the market value of the total assets. Nothing big here. But notice that this is market values. Market values drive our analysis. And so, overall, just as a simple equation, and the book doesn't go too much further than the simple equation, although they go into these details over here in a minute, and I'll go through that in a second here. The weighted average cost of capital is the weight of debt in the capital structure times the after-tax cost of debt plus the weight of equity in the capital structure times the overall cost of equity. In general, we don't really do too much worrying about the R sub N and the R sub P because, for one thing, we're normally looking at companies not when they're issuing new equity. We're looking at them in their general, the hustle and flow of their typical operations. And we also aren't looking at the R sub P because, like I said, it's not there much anymore. Now, I can break this down even further. I could do it in the full-blown version. The weighted average cost of capital is W sub D, R after tax of D plus W sub E times the cost of the old equity plus W sub N times the cost of the new equity plus W sub P times the cost of preferred. That's the full-blown version of it. We generally wouldn't need to worry too much about that, except in special cases. We can kind of rely on the simpler formula right there. Now, you remember back in the dark days that we could price a security by saying the price now should be the dividend one period out divided by the cost of equity minus the growth rate. You might remember that from some place in your dark past. Remember that was when we early in the course when I did that calculation, and I actually got pretty darn close to the cost. What was that target that I did? I mean, you can do pretty good. As long as the dividend is there and it's got a constant growth, this is a decent formula. Now, watch what I do. This is just some algebra. I'm just going to rearrange this a little bit. First, I'm going to cross-multiply so that I get R sub E minus G equals the dividend one period out over the price now. And then I've got R sub E equals D sub 1, dividend one period out, over P0 plus the growth rate. There's how I get, that's the formula for getting the cost of internally generated equity. That's it right there. That is the way we do it. The other way we can do it is actually use the cap M. We can just go straight down the nose of the thing and use the cap M. So either way, you can get the cost of equity. Remember, the R sub S equals R sub F plus beta. I can do it either way. This would be one I would use more for a mature company that had a stable dividend policy and a stable growth rate. That's probably the one I would use for a mature company. But if I were looking at just a generic company, I'd probably just hit cap M. Cap M, I can do R sub E equals R sub F, risk-free rate, plus the beta of the stock times the expected return to the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate. I can get it that way, too. Either one of these gets me the cost of internally generated equity. That's how I get it. That's how I would get the R sub E, one way or the other. Now, in the homework they'll give you, and I'll do another example on the last class, on the last new class of new material on Tuesday. But there you go. That's the cost of internally generated equity. You can do it either way. Now, actually, the cost of new equity, I just pull a trick. We pull a trick for that. Look, when we're considering the cost of internally generated equity, we're dividing by the price of the stock, the current price of the stock, okay? Notice, by the way, that's why companies are very interested in keeping their stock price going up, because if the price of the stock goes up, the cost of internally generated equity is actually going down. That's why companies, even though I've had companies ask me when I was consulting, I was telling them, look, the price is sliding. We got to move on this. And they'd say, well, why should we care about the price going down? We got our money in the offering. And this is why you have to, even after you have sold the stock, you still have to worry about the price, because as the price goes down, the cost of those shareholders to you goes up. Now, the trick we do for the cost of new equity is just simply this. We say, look, our investment bankers are going to sell the stock for P0. They're going to sell the stock at the market price. But we're not going to get the market price. We're going to get the market price minus their float. Minus their float. That's the key there, is that that float, the bigger that is. Now, also, I should point out, oftentimes the float we taught, say, as a percentage. Okay? So in other words, let's try this. A company just issued a $0.25 per share dividend, which is expected to grow at 5% for the foreseeable future. Okay? Let me do this. I'm running out of room here. Let me put this up here. Okay. The current price of the stock is $12 per share. So now I can get the expected return on equity, the return on equity. The cost of equity. I should say cost of equity. I'm sorry. Okay, so now we've got a dividend of two, a current dividend. This is D0. We're going to have to grow that one period because the formula asks for the dividend one period out over the current price of the stock, $12 per share. And then you can just hammer the thing out. It's nothing hard here. 12 divided by, oops, day. What am I doing? 0.25 times 1.05. That's D1. Oh, shut up. Equals. Okay, so that's D1, 0.2625. Divided by 12 dollars. Now we add the growth rate, 5.05. So I get a cost of equity 7.1875%. That's your cost of equity. Okay? Now, here's the thing, though. Suppose the company decides it doesn't have enough money to finance a project, so it's going to have to issue some stock. And so it talks to, they have a discussion with you, sir, the investment banker, and then you, being a scoundrel, say, well, we're going to take 10% of the price of every share we sell on you, okay? So in other words, I, the company, will not get $12 for every share I issue. I will get $12 minus $1.20. If he's going to charge me a float of 10%, that means that I am going to not see $1.20 of the $12 for every share he sells. Okay? So in other words, the cost of new equity, R sub n, would be the dividend 0.25 times 1 plus 0.05 over, in this case, $12 minus 10% of $12. plus the growth rate of 5%. Now watch what happens when I do this. Clear this out, and let's pull it again. So we're going to do point... Did I write something wrong there? Okay. Yeah, because the float here, the F, is $1.20. Okay, so 0.25 times the growth rate, 1.05. And then we're going to divide that by, open parenthesis, $12 minus $1.20. I mean, you could have done $12 times 0.9, would have given you the same thing, plus 0.05. 7.431. So in other words, the cost of new equity is 24 basis points above the cost of existing equity. 24 basis points above. So the bottom line here is simply that when you're talking about when you're talking about financing a new project, you can finance it, one, with money you've already earned, two, with borrowing new money from borrowing money, or three, from issuing new common stock. They go up in that order. The cost goes up. By the way, one last one, the cost of preferred. Remember when I did the preferred dividend? The price of preferred is just the flat dividend because it pays the same dividend forever, like that. So the cost of preferred, R sub P, is nothing but the flat dividend that's in the stock certificate itself divided by the price right now of the preferred stock. It's a very simple formula. So, I mean, honestly, the funniest thing is about it, the cost of preferred is actually fairly low compared to the cost of internally generated equity and externally generated equity. The cost of preferred is below those, and yet companies set that aside as a possible financing option. They go with debt or equity. Now, the bottom line here is simply this. When you're getting a new project together, you got something big, you're not going to finance that with existing shareholder money, probably. You're going to borrow money or issue new stock to do it, especially if it's some kind of a big 800-pound gorilla of a project. You're probably going to have to go out there into the capital markets. And the choice is, are you going to borrow money to do it, or are you going to issue stock to do it? Now, there's an interesting thing there. Well, the cost of debt is going to be less in normal circumstances than the cost of equity. The question would be, why would there be a question about what you should do when it comes to financing a new project? If the cost of debt is lower than the cost of equity, then clearly, by borrowing money, you are actually going to have your weighted average cost of capital go down, or it's not going to go up. Using equity, which is more expensive than debt. And by the way, normally, I threw that one up there on the board. You're talking about cost of equity that can be in excess of 20%. 20% versus you could issue bonds at 6%. Why would anyone ever issue equity? Well, the reason is if you keep borrowing and borrowing, the cost of that debt will start going up. The lenders will start saying, you're asking for an awful lot of exposure to risk. Now, I'm going to show you one last thing here, something very interesting. I want to do this. You recall that I've talked about this company on a number of occasions. This company is dog meat. It's dead. It's out of circulation. Well, interestingly enough, something wonderful happened yesterday with this company. It reported surprisingly strong earnings. And so it's kind of one of those things where don't give up on companies until you're at the graveyard. And even then, you might want to listen to see if there's any knocking on the casket. Because, I mean, it could be, you know, the living dead coming, you know, some wannabe actor from the Walking Dead. But in this case, the interesting thing is that this company seems to be rising from the dead. I mean, this company was a piece of dead meat on the side of the road that even the buzzards wouldn't eat. And yet now, let me go back here real quick and emphasize this one more time. Is there some reason this sucks? Okay. Yeah, no, I'm trying to back up. Okay. Now let's do our filing type. Well, we can use the filing. We can use the 10-Q they just issued for what I want to show you. Okay, financial statements, statement of the consolidated balance sheets. Let's go down here and look at stockholders' equity. There's essentially your stockholders' equity right there, that number. And yet, there's what the market thinks it's worth. Trust the market, not the accounting numbers. The market will burn you, it will ruin you, it will make you have fits in your investments. But the one thing that the market will never do, just like when you are visited by the devil himself, he will say something that's quite true. He will say, I will never lie to you. And that's the same as, was that really, what the hell was that? Okay. The market will never lie to you. Okay? It will burn you, bankrupt you, make you angry, but it will not lie to you. So you keep that in mind. That's all I have for you today.